Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Rest is History, the latest bonus episode. And we meet in the aftermath of an extraordinary moment in an auction house in the former Kingdom of Wessex. So, Tom, this is the news that you have bought a dinosaur. And this has made the most popular English-speaking news website in the world, the Mail Online. I've run a big story about this. So it's obviously massive news. Would you like to talk us through it?
Yes. So ever since I was about four, it's been my dream to own a dinosaur. I mean, what self-respecting young lad would not want to own a dinosaur?
I don't think children want to own dinosaurs.
I thought you said Arthur wanted a dinosaur now that he'd seen I got one.
No, it's hastily minted by Lego, but it's not hastily minted by a dinosaur.
Okay, well, I'm disappointed, and I think the lesser thing for that. So I'd always wanted to buy one.
Yeah.
I have been down in outside Salisbury, in the village I grew up in, the past couple of weeks. And my brother pointed out that Woolley and Wallace, the distinguished Salisbury auctioneers, mm-hmm. would be having an auction of vintage furniture.
Oh, fascinating.
last Tuesday. But at the end of this catalogue of vintage furniture, there was obviously a job lot of fossils that was being sold. And among them was the fossil of a Psittacosaurus, the parrot lizard, which is a kind of proto-ceratopsian. So that's the ceratopsians of the most famous of which is Triceratops. This is a very early one from about 120 million years ago, very early Cretaceous period, from the Gobi Desert. And there it was in a kind of museum case. So it had been in a museum. The museum had got rid of it, sold it to this bloke, and now it was up for auction. And the estimated price was £4,000 to £6,000. And I thought, I'll never have a chance like this again.
It's so quite
I
was a lot of money, though.
It is quite a lot of money, but it's a lifetime dream. So I kind of saved up my pocket money for it, and went to the auction. I'd never been to an auction before, full of tension and excitement. I'd been kind of waking up in the middle of the night worrying about this. And I'd been looking through the catalogue, and it was all full of dreary, you know, kind of
chairs.
Georgian cabinets and Victorian pianos. And I was just dreary. I couldn't imagine anyone wanting it. And there was a dinosaur. And I was thinking, this is the one thing everyone will be wanting. And when it came up, obviously, because the only people who were cognizant of this auction were people who were interested in period furniture. And they weren't interested, it turned out, in dinosaurs. So I got it for £3,500. And
great.
I was so happy, firstly, to have got the dinosaur. And second, basically, to have saved at least £2,500. So I felt basically I'd got it for free. And so I jumped up in the air and I kind of punched the air. And I had my father with me, who was absolutely oblivious to what was going on.
He was unmoved.
So he was the kind of the embodiment of the English sang-froid that I suspect, Dominic, you admire.
Well,
whereas
Tom,
I was behaving in a kind of excitable manner.
Your celebrations, do you know what they remind me of? Now, I don't know if you probably won't get this reference, but one or two listeners might. Early 1980s, Luton Town had to play Manchester City in the final match of the season, and the winner would stay up, and Luton scored, Raddy Antich scored for Luton, and David Pleat, the then beige-suited Luton manager, did a jig on the pitch at Main Road, ran across, waving his arms in the air in celebration. Very, very similar scenes to your celebration in the auction house, which occasioned a lot of mirth online, it's fair to say.
Well, yes. So it got recorded by CCTV.
Yeah.
And so they said, would I mind if they put it up? And I said, no, not at all. And the next thing I know, it's being put in the Daily Mail. And a very shrewd comment from Ian Jones. You know, I'm starting to think this article was a male hatchet job designed to diminish Tom's standing in relation to one of the paper's principal contributors. So, Dominic, how do you plead to that?
That's very funny. That is very funny. Well, Tom, it's
is that what's been going on?
No, it's a very boring thing for me to say, but actually that was on Mail Online, not in the Daily Mail.
Oh,
they are two different operations. So the people who are masterminding your appearance are living currently in a bunker in Manhattan. Talking about, I mean, you're lucky they didn't say you were, you know,
Spider-Man.
Flaunting your curves.
Yeah.
Tom Holland steps out in
his pecs.
In his tweed jacket or whatever. So my thoughts are, if you wanted a dinosaur and if you were consistent to your long-established view about dinosaurs, why didn't you just get a budgerigar?
Because I don't believe in keeping live dinosaurs as pets.
Live dinosaurs as pets.
Yeah.
So the producer, Dom, wants to know what's it look like and how big?
Well, it looks, if you imagine kind of lizard that's been run over by a steamroller, that's a bit what it looks like. But it's called a parrot dinosaur, and we've called it Polly, because it has a kind of beak. And if you think of Triceratops, it's got a kind of beak, hasn't it? Can you envisage it?
Yeah, I can. Yeah.
So that's what it looks like. I would say it's about, I'm terrible at measurements.
Is it the size of a violin?
It's a bit longer than that.
Okay.
A bit bigger than that. But it's small enough that it can be hung from a wall.
Are you going to put it on the wall?
Is that my study? Yeah.
Are you?
Yeah.
Your study, but lots of people won't see it. What do you want people to see it?
I'm just going
to
hide it.
Okay, fine. Well, selfish.
Just for me. I'll hug it. Look at it.
Okay.
No, I mean, anybody who wants to come and see it, very welcome to, you know, get an entry ticket.
I was going
to
say, that's a very dangerous invitation.
Go to the gift shop.
Yeah.
Come and see the exhibit. But I also got loads of other stuff. So I got some algae, which are 2 billion years old.
That's a demented purchase. What are you going to do with them?
I'm going to put it in my little museum. I've got a little museum of paleontological treasures.
Right.
I've got some sauropod bone marrow. I also got a large dinosaur bone. It just said dinosaur bone. So right. I don't know from which dinosaur it's
or indeed got. Whether it is a dinosaur bone.
I think it is.
Do even members of your immediate family express interest in your museum? Or is it a purely personal?
No, the girls are very, very keen. They love the idea of this dinosaur being called Polly. They've very much embraced her and accepted her into the family as, you know, a member of the family.
Katie's not even in England.
No, but she's seen the video and she's seen the photo of it.
Yeah, she's no doubt delighted to see you appearing on Mail Online.
She's thrilled. well, it sets up our forthcoming episode on Love Island, doesn't it?
What, the dinosaur?
Being on Mail Online. What it's all about, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, and they're actually pestering me to put it up in the kitchen. So no, they're very keen.
Okay, good.
But you said that you were going to say what you thought about the dinosaur.
Well, I told you I thought you should have got a budgerigar.
Oh,
if you're that bothered about, I mean, £3,500 is a lot of money, and I think you could have gone on holiday for that money.
I could, but I wouldn't have a 120-million-year-old dinosaur.
You're more into dinosaurs than I am. I mean,
that is indisputably true, Dominic.
Yeah, that is
absolutely indisputably true. Meanwhile, talking of dinosaurs, I see from our briefing notes that you've got into a fight with the former BNP leader Nick Griffin on Twitter. So the BNP, just explain who the BNP. Are they still a
I think they're defunct now. So they're the British National Party. They're a far right party. I think they would dispute that they are neo-Nazis, but I think some of their critics would say they were neo-Nazis. And they were sort of hovering, I suppose their heyday, such as it was late 90s, early 2000s, probably the anxiety about immigration. I mean, they were, and frankly, probably still are, an overtly racist party. So they're the sort of successors to a party really in the 1960s, 70s, 80s called the National Front. And they're a far-right party. Nick Griffin was their leader, and he was an unusual man because he'd been to Cambridge. Is that right, Tom?
He went
to Cambridge.
He had.
And then became the leader of the BNP and was famously invited onto Question Time, which is the kind of BBC's flagship political discussion.
Where they have four politicians. Well, they have four guests, three of whom are four of whom are politicians, and then
exactly.
One is usually a comic.
Exactly. A sort of random guest.
Yes.
So for our overseas listeners, this was a very controversial moment because it was seen as the BBC sort of legitimizing an extremist minority party. But he was, I think, generally perceived to have performed very badly on Question Time. I don't think he was ever invited back, was he? I can't remember.
He sweated a lot, didn't he?
I didn't watch it.
He had a shifty giggle.
I actually never watched Question Time because it's just excruciating.
I watched it. They had five people who were there to oppose him.
And
they all just kind of jabbed and prodded him.
They all stamped on him.
And he didn't come out of it very well.
So you say this was a fight on Twitter, but this isn't really a fight because I wasn't aware this had happened. I don't think you can have a fight that you're oblivious to, can you?
That's a very good question. Yeah.
What did he say, Tom?
This is apparently a tweet that he put out. When Dominic Sambrook writes about the Cuban Missile Crisis without mentioning the key fact that it was a response to the stationing of US nukes in Turkey, you know he's either a very poor court historian or a conscious warmongering liar, #Putin.
So the question that in my mind was, how come it didn't occur to him that I could be both? a court historian and a warmongering liar. Yeah. And also, I'm not sure what the hashtag Putin is there for. Is that him stating his fealty?
Basically? I think it is. And I imagine that he's accusing you of being a NATO shill.
A NATO shill. I mean, if you're going to shill for anybody, I think being a NATO shill is probably who I'd shill for.
So what was it? What was the article?
The article was, we talked about the article some weeks ago. It was an article saying, it was an article about nuclear war.
So oh, yes, was, I remember, yes.
So yeah. Actually, the reference to the, it wasn't an article about the Cuban Missile Crisis. So the reference to the Cuban Missile Crisis was sort of in, it was about three sentences saying the world came to the brink in the Cuban Missile Crisis. But thankfully, Kennedy didn't press the button. Khrushchev blinked.
Yeah.
The Soviets withdrew the missiles. And I mean, it was literally like that. It's that classic thing that people who get very cross if you don't sort of mention everything in an article, all sides. Yeah. But obviously being criticized by Nick Griffin, I mean, I think I can quite easily cope with that.
I see that you responded with a witty sally. Shall I read it? Shall I read it out?
Only on the Discord to our members. Yes, you can read it. Okay.
I'll have to add him to my enemies list. Quite an eclectic bunch. Alexei Sale, Andrew Marr, John Savage, and now Nick Griffin. When I seize power and incarcerate them on the Isle of Man, they could form a Beatles tribute band. So your enemies, Alexei Sale, dissed you.
Yeah.
For your documentary on the 80s.
Despised. Yeah, was it the 80s? Delia Smith. Delia Smith was the flashpoint, I believe.
Andrew Marr was rude about you in a novel because you'd been given him a less than glowing review.
Correct.
A tepid review. John Savage, John Savage writes on punk and
he does, yeah,
teenagers and all kinds of stuff.
This came about because some people on the Discord were chatting about would they do an episode about punk, which we think would be good fun, actually, the Sex Pistols and the sort of 70s in Britain. And somebody said, oh, they could get John Savage. And somebody else said, no, they couldn't. And they then tweet sort of put up a link to an interview he'd given where he said I was just the worst person in Britain.
And why did he think you were the worst person in Britain?
Evil, fascistic,
right.
Dreadful person who clearly, I think what irritated him was that I had clearly read his book and sort of made use of it, but had drawn different conclusions.
Okay, well, that's...
He didn't like that.
I mean, it would be quite fun to have him and Nick Griffin together.
I think have the four. Have a panel.
If he thinks you're a fascist, God knows what he's making Nick Griffin.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I mean, he pretty much is a fascist.
Well, he is literally fascist, yes. Isn't he? Yeah.
Allegedly. We don't want to be sued by Nick Griffin. So no. For the BNP's lawyers are listening, allegedly. Obviously you have your issues. We don't want to dig too deeply into those. The one thing I will say about Nick Griffin is that Nick Griffin tried to move to Hungary in 2017. So Viktor Orban's Hungary. But he was banned from Hungary on the grounds of being a national security threat.
Oh.
So that's quite an achievement because Viktor Orban is not a sort of hand-wringing...
liberal by any stretch.
No, no. So anyway, I'm not a great...
He's more a Jobbik man, wouldn't he be?
He is Jobbik. Or Golden Dawn in Greece.
No, Jobbik, I think, have...
Have they ceased to exist?
They've become gone third way, I think.
Oh, have they?
They kind of melded themselves into that alliance of anti-Orban parties in the last...
God, Tom, your knowledge of Hungarian politics, very impressive.
Thank you very much. I'd keep abreast of European politics, don't it?
The first Lord Rothermere was a great aficionado of Hungarian politics, and there's a boulevard named after him in Budapest.
Yes, sir.
He wrote a massive article in the Daily Mail in the 1920s saying Hungary had been very hard done by in the Treaty of Trianon or something like that.
And did the Rothermeres have any other kind of yearnings after...
Interwar politics.
Political leaders.
I don't think they ever expressed any opinions, actually, Tom. I think if you go back through the archives, you literally find nothing. There's nothing.
No mention of Hitler at all.
None whatsoever. Should we talk about the American Civil War?
Let's get on to the American Civil War, Dominic. I've listened to the whole... I've listened to all four.
I recorded all four.
It was a while ago, and it was quite an intense experience, wasn't it? Because as we said repeatedly over the course of the episodes, it was a Herculean performance from Adam Smith, that we recorded all four in one go. And I kind of emerged from that recording feeling a bit dazed and shattered, to be honest.
To be honest, you felt brutalized, I think, Tom.
I did feel a bit brutalized. I couldn't really remember. So my brain felt that it had been jumped up and down on.
Yeah,
I couldn't really remember any of it.
Yeah.
So, and I haven't really, I've been so busy the past fortnight, I didn't have time to listen back to the episodes. But I played cricket in a couple of matches over the weekend. And driving there, I listened to all the episodes. And I thought, you know, I thought they were brilliant.
Oh, that's good.
I thought they were really, really brilliant.
It's great that you're using the bonus episodes to congratulate ourselves.
I'm congratulating Adam,
yeah,
who I thought was just a brilliant, brilliant guest. And I'm also congratulating you, because you were very, very keen on doing this, much keener than I was. Basically, because I'd never been able to get a handle on the Civil War. I kind of knew the greatest hits, but I'd never been able to kind of thread them together. So I had the pearls, but not the string on which you would make the necklace.
That's a nice image.
But I felt that Adam made a necklace.
He did. I saw Adam 2 nights ago, because we had used to be very good friends when we were doing our PhDs, and we'd sort of lost touch a bit, really. So we went out for dinner, and in the course of the dinner, he said he bitterly regretted not having done any accents himself.
He did the lady in a crinoline.
It is, but it was only very fleeting.
It was an excellent impression.
And actually, in reality, he does do excellent, excellent accents. And his American accents are really first class.
Well, you'd expect him. He's a professor of American history.
Yeah, but a lot of professors don't do impersonations.
Oh, come on. You're not going to become professor of American history at Oxford University without being able to do a full range of impressions.
That's... Well, he does. I mean, he does do the Margaret Thatcher Gettysburg himself in his lectures, but he didn't do it on the program.
Well, I hope that we could maybe persuade him to come back.
Well, he said to me...
And he could unfurl his...
He said to me that he would be very keen to do the War of Independence, the American Revolution.
I was going to ask if he would do that.
Because he teaches that at Oxford.
Well, that would be wonderful.
I think what the public are crying out for is the American Revolution from a British perspective.
And we're recording this on the 4th of July.
Exactly. I think that's what the American people want, actually. Because I think a lot of them now, Tom, let's be frank, are slightly regretting. Slightly regretting the decision made more than 200 years ago. Yeah. Right.
So, London in the Wild. I was surprised that the discussion of Southern presidents in the live stream missed out on Harry Truman. He hailed from Missouri, which had been a slave state before the Civil War and managed to be claimed by both Union and Confederacy, with soldiers fighting on both sides. He also made some significant progress on civil rights problems. He's probably most famous in this regard for desegregating the military.
So Harry Truman, very underrated president in my view, very impressive president. One of these people who's a complete
Stanley
nobody.
Baldwin I suppose Stanley Baldwin didn't nuke Japanese cities.
He would have done that. I think
the bomber always gets through.
Yes, exactly. The bomber always gets through. No, he's the Clement Attlee of American politics. I mean, they take the reins at pretty much the same time. He's the little man with glasses who served in World War I. He's a former failed haberdasher, Harry Truman. He's not quite, I mean, to pick up on London in the Wild's point, he's not really Southern. Missouri is a border state, as he says. So it's not a deep South, kind of what was called, inverted commas, the Black Belt kind of plantation area. So it's not quite the same. And yes, he does desegregate the military, which is a very big step. And you kind of had to do that, I think, at the end of World War II, where African Americans had, you know, performed with tremendous heroism alongside their white compatriots.
And especially since that, you know, they were fighting against the racist.
Right.
Terrorism.
Exactly. I mean, exactly. And that undoubtedly, I think that fact, Tom, makes it much, much harder to make the argument for segregation in the 1950s and 60s.
Yeah, I think the impact of the Second World War on 60s liberalism is enormous. Kind of like a delayed shock.
Although, having said that, black soldiers had also fought, you know, tremendously impressively in the First World War. There was some unit called the Harlem Hellraisers or the Harlem Hellboys or something anyway. And they were not allowed to fight alongside white Americans. Often they served under French command rather than American. They were very heroic, and they went back and were treated, you know, with contempt. And so actually, maybe it took two world wars to do it.
Because the framing of the First World War, it's a fight for civilization, for which read European civilization, for which read white European civilization.
Yeah, I guess so.
Whereas the Second World War was a fight against the racist tyranny. And so if that's the reason you're fighting Nazis, you can't then be racist yourself, really. I mean, you can. Of course, I mean, you know, the opportunities for hypocrisy are limitless, but it become the strain, the ideological strain, I think, ultimately becomes too great.
I think that's right. I think that's definitely right. So we've got a question from what I think is Dublin Steve. It just says Dublin Steve here. but Dublin Steve asks, The Republican Party once seemed more progressive, in inverted commas, than the Democratic Party. When did this change? Was the influx of Irish emigrants the start? No, it definitely wasn't the start, because Irish immigration predates the Civil War, but also Irish, the Irish vote tends to be Democratic, because the Republican Party is the party historically of kind of slightly puritanical middle-class Protestants, you know, well-meaning Protestants, if you like, and the Democrats are the party of everybody else.
Catholics.
Yeah, Catholics. But, you know, so obviously the Kennedys are Democrats for that reason. Well, the two parties didn't have set identities. I mean, that's a great mistake that I think a lot of Europeans make when they look at American political history. They assume the Republicans stood for this and the Democrats for that. But actually what you had was a very complicated system where you would have, for example, let's say the 1950s, the South was run, it was pretty much a one-party state run by Democrats who in some respects were much more right-wing than some Republicans. But Northern Democrats, on the other hand, were closer to the labor unions and more liberal. And so it was a very complicated picture, which has now become more simple. And it's that simplicity is part of the problem with American
democracy. Yeah, because Adam was talking about this, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He was saying that what's distinctive now, as it was distinctive in the 1850s, is that you have two parties that have no commonality at all.
Yeah.
There's no blurring of the issues at all.
And regional dominance. So he wrote an article in the Sunday Times about this.
Yeah, it's very good.
This Sunday. And he, you know, the point is the red states will always be red and the blue states will always be blue. And he said to me when we met that the issue will be he thinks the red states, it'd be really interesting to know what our listeners make of this. He thinks the Republicans will probably dominate federal national politics for a generation to come. And indeed the Supreme Court, conceivably for decades, because some of the younger justices, I mean, they're going to be around for decades. So the issue is when the blue states are net contributors to the federal budget. And it's the point at which they start to form defensive associations to try and protect their
laws.
No
taxation without representation.
And they start saying, why are we paying for a federal government that...
That is very triggering for Americans, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very... Well, it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. So, Tom, let's move on slightly, shall we, from the Civil War to talk about the British Library.
Oh, Dominic.
Because you have been appointed to the board of the British Library. So you have become a Quangocrat,
yes.
Jobsworth.
Yes, I have. I've become a member of the great and the good.
What is this? This is your attempt to get a MBE or something, is it?
I'm aiming slightly higher, Dominic.
Are you? You're aiming for knighthood. Like Ian Botham.
At the very least. The Order of the Garter. Well, my attempt to get the Garter was foiled by the Daily Mail, because I went and did that thing, the talk at the Chalk Valley History Festival, saying that the Queen was the greatest monarch.
Yeah, you
and then the headline was, Historian says the Queen is boring.
Yeah, that was shocking. That was unpatriotic.
No, it wasn't unpatriotic at all.
And actually, that was vile. Right, tell us about the British Library.
Well, I have served my time, to be fair. So I was chair of the Society of Authors. And the Society of Authors is basically the trades union of writers.
Yeah.
And then I have also done two terms as chair of the Public Lending Right Committee. And Public Lending Right is the money that is paid to authors for loans in libraries.
Yep.
And that was originally a kind of independent entity, and it got absorbed into the British Library. There was a bonfire of quangos, I think, when the Cameron government came in. They had a bonfire of quangos, and PLR was one of the quangos that got put on the bonfire and absorbed into the British Library. I've done years and years of this kind of stuff.
God, I knew that you spent so much time on quangos. What for? You're just a joiner. You're a public-spirited person.
I want to serve my fellow authors, Dominic. I've been serving you. I've been helping you out.
Have you? What have you done for me?
I've got you more money for your library books.
I mean, it's a pittance. It's an absolute pittance.
It's better than nothing. If you want to buy a dinosaur, you start saving now. I'm helping you out. This is what comes of public service. You get sneers from...
You do, from self-interest.
Daily Mail columnists.
You do.
It's all very easy to snipe from the sidelines, isn't it?
But there are two kinds of people in life, aren't there? There are people who like joining committees and doing their best to help their fellow men, and there are other people who like sitting at home and sneering at the bien pensant.
Exactly. But Dominic, I know that this is just a sham, because you're on committees yourself, aren't you? you're on the committee of the Public Records Office or something?
No, I was on the National Archives Trust. I'm no longer a member of that, Tom.
Are you not?
Do you know why? I spend far too much time talking to you. So I've sacrificed the public good for your private interest.
Well, that's excellent.
All right. Now, we've got a very complicated issue here that which the producers have asked us to talk about, even though I think we're probably both utterly out of our depth.
Yeah, we
are. So there's a member of the Rest is History Club who has been very vocal on the Discord in recent weeks, I think only in recent weeks, and popped up on the live stream, and he's called Lee Kuan Yew Respecter. Now, LKY, as I'll call him to avoid having to keep pronouncing that, was the boss of Singapore, basically, independent Singapore, during the kind of Cold War years. And he was very pro-British. He was very pro-British.
He was quite contemptuous of Britain.
Yeah, he thought they were weak and a bit they'd become feeble. He thought they'd lost their fighting spirit. But people like Dennis Healy loved him, thought he was great. Because he was very, you know, he didn't tear down all the stuff. He kept up the statue of Raffles and he kept up the traditions. He banned people chewing gum. he was very ferocious. Well,
you get caned if you leave kind of marks on the toilets.
Yeah. So it's a bit like Preston Brooks in the 1850s in the yes. US Congress. So he basically made Singapore into this incredibly successful. He turned it from this sort of slight backwater into a this huge kind of glittering city state.
Incredibly rich city state.
Very rich. Have you been to Singapore, Tom?
I've never been to Singapore.
No, I haven't.
I'd be absolutely terrified.
You're going to go around chewing gum and throwing litter around?
Well, I'd be so nervous that I would inadvertently put some drugs in my luggage.
Right.
I would just look so shifty and sweaty as I went through it.
Yeah.
Some bastard has, some smuggler has put it in my luggage or something, and then I'd be hanged or something.
Peter Hitchens.
There was an American teenager, must have years ago, decades ago, who I think dropped gum or something like that. Or disrespected,
I remember this. And
some
he was caned, wasn't he?
Yes, and there was kind of very detailed articles in the press talking about how his buttocks would be filleted by a rattan cane, and it doesn't really make me want to go there, I'll be honest.
I think it's got a very nice zoo on the other hand.
Yeah.
So
it's got a lovely cricket ground. So if I get the chance to play there, I'd go.
And the LKY Respecter chap, he compares him to Augustus, Lee Kuan Yew. He says they're the closest to a Platonic philosopher king. Do you think Augustus was a Platonic philosopher king?
No.
You know what? You've called him a terrorist, which I think
he was a youthful terrorist. He became the father of his people.
And that's too harsh, but there you go.
But we should stick up for LKY Respecter, because his argument is that LKY took an irrelevant third world fishing colony and turned it into one of the most efficient, safest, and least corrupt countries in the world. I mean, it is an astonishing feat.
Yeah, I think that's all probably true.
And he's a strong counterpoint to Mr. Marxist historian Dominic Sandbrook's materialist view of the world. If anybody else had been in charge, Singapore would not be where it is today. So how do you respond to that, Mr. Marxist?
I think that is probably right. I think there are a few people, obviously, aren't there, in the 20th century who you look at and you say, well, you know, things could have gone differently. Sort of fathers of their nation kind of people often. So yeah. Mustafa Kemal with Turkey.
I heard a talk about the legacy of empire at the Tor Valley History Festival, told by a historian whose name I can't actually remember at the moment, but he lives in Singapore.
Okay.
And he said that to mark the 200th anniversary of Singapore's founding by Raffles, they did something where they put a kind of light show on the statue of Raffles so that it kind of vanished into the fabric of the skyscraper that stood behind it, the building that stood behind it.
All right. They cancelled Raffles for their...
Were they? Because he was still there. So it was a kind of stimulating take on...
I reviewed a book about Raffles. He is a great subject. He would be a great subject for a podcast. He's sort of... no one knows who he is now, but he was such a fantastic entrepreneur.
He's kind of an entrepreneurial flashman, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think we should do Raffles, actually. I think it'd be good fun. I think we should do it on location.
Yeah, let's do it on location.
I want to see...
Oh my God, what's this in your luggage?
Exactly. let us talk about shoes. William Trossachs. in your discourse, that's a grand word for the saloon bar. In your discourse, much is made of the Kaiser and his footwear faux pas. Is there a generally acceptable footwear code for boating and sailing these days? I may have reason to be so engaged soon, I don't want to be responsible for it.
No, well, that's very, very wise precaution. I think that standards have gone down.
Right. So just deck shoes generally, surely.
I think deck shoes are acceptable. I'm not going to pretend that I tend to hang out on yachts. So I'm not
flip-flops
really sure.
Or flip-flops.
Flip-flops, port. I think, would cause an international situation.
So Havaianas or whatever they're called. Is that what they're called? They're no good. Crocs, Tom? You wouldn't wear a Croc. I don't see you as a Crocs man.
To offer reassurance to William Trossachs.
Yeah.
I think to cause a kind of full-blown international incident.
You need to.
You probably need to be the militaristic autocrat of a very powerful European nation.
Yeah, you probably.
So do. If you are that, be you know, do watch out. Don't go for the flip flops. But if you're not, I think it'll probably be okay. You'll probably just get away with you know the bristling of moustaches. Monocles may drop out of eyes.
I mean, Richard Nixon wore very smart shoes on the beach, and I wouldn't recommend that. I think that is poor. Now, William Trossachs also asks, has footwear error caused any other historical matters of import? The invading Danes standing on Scots thistles, Zola Budd running a race, or Gandhi eschewing sturdy brogues? So.
Good question.
So Zola Budd ran barefoot, didn't she? And this was sort of, it was an interesting one. Because
so she was
of course,
a South African athlete who while apartheid was on, who we imported to win us medals in the Olympics.
Yes.
Gave her a British passport.
But it was completely contrived, wasn't it? And her still running barefoot, which was supposedly what she had done growing up in South Africa, was seen, it sort of was a marker of exoticism, wasn't it? That it sort of reminded people that she wasn't actually really, you know, British. She was South African.
She hadn't been practicing in Luton.
She hadn't.
And didn't she, in the race, she knocked over...
Mary Decker.
The American sweetheart.
Yeah, Los Angeles Olympics. So she was the home favourite, Mary Decker. And Zola Budd knocked her over and then didn't win herself. Somebody else won. And it was just a general... I remember watching that live, actually.
I have thought of a footwear error.
Have you?
Do you want me to tell or do you want to continue describing?
Something? No, I absolutely want to hear you talk about it.
Okay, so the classic footwear error is Julius Caesar started wearing the distinctive purple boots. I mean, so patricians could wear purple boots, but these were very distinctively had a hint of the royal to them before the Ides of March. Ooh. And so this may have precipitated his assassination.
You know, there
so
is
that
an
would
episode,
be a classic footwear error.
There is an episode to be done on footwear shoes because, of course, we could talk about Caligula, little boots.
Yeah. We could talk about the Persian emperor. High heels,
yeah. Exactly. We could talk about Wellington. And whether or not he invented Wellington boots.
Yeah, okay. So top footwear in history.
And then we could end with Birkenstock liberals. You don't hear that expression anymore, but people used to talk about that in America and about as George W. Bush's critics were Birkenstock liberals, i.e., Volvo driving, shabbily drinking Californians and New Yorkers wearing Birkenstock sandals.
Okay.
So there's lots to talk about there. Right, and of course, sandals and the Liberal Democrats. Another big theme of British life. So there was some talk, Tom, about the pronunciation of the word of the river that is running through Washington, D.C.
What is it? Potomac?
It's the Potomac. And we were talking just before we started recording about all these sort of American false friends, the faux amis, as they're called in French. So words that look like they can be pronounced. So
you were saying Los Angeles. Which all British people call Los Angeles.
Yeah, you called it Los Angeles. You just said Los Angeles. But Americans don't call it Los Angeles. They call it Los Angeles.
Well, I said Los Angeles the first time, Dominic.
But Sam Manas wrote in about the Potomac. Where's Sam Manas from, Tom?
He's from Maryland.
He's from Maryland.
See, I would say Maryland.
Yeah, you would say Maryland.
But it's not Maryland.
No, it's not.
It's Maryland.
And there's lots of others like, I mean, obviously Birmingham, Alabama is very famous.
But the thing about the Potomac,
yeah.
The Potomac is that passage that I read, I checked with you beforehand how you pronounced it. And I still got it wrong.
Yeah, you did still get it wrong.
I'm really sorry. I can only apologize. And only say that I don't mind when Americans call Edinburgh Edinburgh.
No. And also, Tom, when we're pronouncing, when we're doing podcasts about ancient Greece or something, we often have wildly different pronunciations of some of the characters.
You can pronounce it in the Greek way or the Latin way. And my Hawaiian pronunciation was shocking.
But presumably people don't know how the Latin or the Roman.
Yeah, you do, because of the meter in the poetry.
Well, we can try. Yeah, you can try to use that to deduce, can't you? But we can't really know.
I think you can pretty much. I mean, you can know where the stresses go.
I suppose
because the whole of Greek and Roman poetry is based on stress. So to that extent, you can.
Okay. And let us end with an email we had from Daz about episode 200, which was the first American Civil War episode. And Daz said this.
Which I think opened with my brilliant impression of Karl Marx, didn't it?
It did. Your Karl Marx and your truly, truly shocking Donald Trump. I played your Donald Trump to my family yesterday. And there was just utter mirth and disbelief. There was a general sense. I get a very strong sense that that's an impersonation of Cato from the Pink Panther films.
No.
Anyway, this is what that. So yeah. you started those episodes with all this, and there was talk of me and Adam going to Piano Bar in New York and so on. And this is what Daz said to the show in his email. He said, "I'm 10 minutes in. I have no idea what you're going on about. It sounds like two schoolboys laughing among themselves. My mate recommended this rubbish. I may slide back to other episodes to work out what this is about. Thanks, Daz." I mean, he's absolutely right.
He is right. But imagine if he goes to the Modern Olympics episode and gets the Dwile flonking.
Yeah. Or get out flicking draft on Dietrich von Hüsler.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Well, that's the thing with the podcast.
I hope we'll get Daz back.
So, you know, we try to give you, the members, a thread that you can... it's like there's a massive narrative that we've planned out. Which will end with episode 2000, which will combine the Kaiser's deck shoes,
dead dogs,
eunuchs, dead dogs, yeah.
Ballerinas.
It'll be like the finale, the show finale. But obviously we don't want to alienate listeners by talking endlessly about these things, which is why, of course, Tom, we've recorded that episode about Love Island that is just nothing but.
Yeah. But I think that's quite, because basically, as I've said, the Love Island episode is essentially an excuse to give the biographies of 10 extraordinary people from a wide range of periods and locations.
Yeah. So that's something to look forward to. Right. I think we've been going on for far too long. Two schoolboys laughing at their own jokes, Tom, as has been aptly described.
Yep.
So we will see you all. What do we got coming up? We've got London. We've got Orwell. We've got Pigeons. We've got Love Island. We've got Scotland. Loads of stuff. All right. Bye-bye.
Coming your way. Bye-bye.